inalienable secret from the whole world. No exceptions. This day week, at breakfast time, everybody present, including Art, and extremely friendly gentlemen, to be at the hotel in Canterbury, where Mrs. McCorber and myself, Auld Lang Syne in chorus, and will expose intolerable ruffian Hip. No more to say, or listen to persuasion. Go immediately. Not capable. Bear society upon the track of devoted and doomed traitor. Hip. With this last repetition of the magic word that had kept him going at all, and in which he surpassed all his previous efforts, Mr. McCorber rushed out of the house, leaving us in a state of excitement, hope, and wonder that reduced us to a condition little better than his own. But even then his passion for writing letters was too strong to be resisted, for while we were yet in the height of our excitement, hope, and wonder, the following pastoral note was brought to me from a neighbouring tavern, at which he had called to write it. Most secret and confidential, my dear sir, I beg to be allowed to convey through you my apologies to your excellent aunt for my late excitement. An explosion of a smouldering volcano, long suppressed, was the result of an internal contest more easily conceived than described. I trust I rendered tolerably intelligible my appointment for the morning of this day week at the House of Public Entertainment at Canterbury, where Mrs. McCorber and myself had once the honour of uniting our voices to yours in the well-known strain of the immortal exciseman nurtured beyond the Tweed. The duty done, and act of reparation performed, which can alone enable me to contemplate my fellow mortal, I shall be known no more. I shall simply require to be deposited in that place of universal resort where, each in his narrow cell for ever laid, the rude forefathers of the hamlet sleep. With the plain inscription, Wilkins McCorber.
This ends side 2 of cassette 22 of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 23.
Mr. Peggotty's dream comes true. By this time, some months had passed since our interview on the bank of the river with Martha. I'd never seen her since, but she had communicated with Mr. Peggotty on several occasions. Nothing had come of her zealous intervention, nor could I infer from what he told me that any clue had ever been obtained for a moment to Emily's fate. I confess that I began to despair of her recovery, and gradually to sink deeper and deeper into the belief that she was dead. His conviction remained unchanged. So far as I know, and I believe his honest heart was transparent to me, he never wavered again in his solemn certainty of finding her. His patience never tired. And although I trembled for the agony it might one day be to him to have his strong assurance shivered at a blow, there was something so religious in it, so affectingly expressive of its anchor being in the purest depths of his fine nature, that the respect and honour in which I held him were exalted every day. His was not a lazy trustfulness that hoped and did no more. He had been a man of sturdy action all his life, and he knew that in all things wherein he wanted help, he must do his own part faithfully and help himself. I've known him set out in the night, on a misgiving that the light might not be by some accident in the window of the old boat, and walk to Yarmouth. I have known him, on reading something in the newspaper that might apply to her, take up his stick and go forth on a journey of 3 or 4 score miles. He made his way by sea to Naples and back, after hearing the narrative to which Miss Dartle had assisted me. All his journeys were ruggedly performed, for he was always steadfast in a purpose of saving money for Emily's sake when she should be found. In all this long pursuit I never heard him repine. I never heard him say he was fatigued or out of heart. Dora had often seen him since our marriage and was quite fond of him. I fancy his figure before me now, standing near her sofa, with his rough cap in his hand and the blue eyes of my child wife raised with a timid wonder to his face. Sometimes of an evening about twilight, when he came to talk with me, I would induce him to smoke his pipe in the garden as we slowly paced to and fro together. And then the picture of his deserted home and the comfortable air it used to have in my childish eyes of an evening when the fire was burning and the wind moaning round it came most vividly into my mind. One evening, at this hour, he told me that he had found Martha waiting near his lodging on the preceding night when he came out, and that she had asked him not to leave London on any account until he should have seen her again. "Did she tell you why?" I inquired. "I asked her, Master Davy," he replied, "but it is but few words as she ever says, and she only got my promise and so went away." "Did she say when you might expect to see her again?" I demanded. "No, Master Davy," he returned, drawing his hand thoughtfully down his face. "I asked that too, but it was more," she said, "than she could tell." As I had long forborne to encourage him with hopes that hung on threads, I made no other comment on this information than that I supposed he would see her soon. Such speculations as it engendered within me I kept to myself, and those were faint enough. I was walking alone in the garden one evening, about a fortnight afterwards. I remember that evening well. It was the second in Mr. Micawber's week of suspense. There had been rain all day, and there was a damp feeling in the air. The leaves were thick upon the trees and heavy with wet, but the rain had ceased, though the sky was still dark, and the hopeful birds were singing cheerfully. As I walked to and fro in the garden, and the twilight began to close around me, their little voices were hushed, and that peculiar silence which belongs to such an evening in the country when the lightest trees are quite still, save for the occasional droppings from their boughs, prevailed. There was a little green perspective of trelliswork and ivy at the side of our cottage, through which I could see from the garden where I was walking into the road before the house. I happened to turn my eyes towards this place as I was thinking of many things, and I saw a figure beyond dressed in a plain cloak. It was bending eagerly towards me and beckoning. "Martha," said I, going to it. "Can you come with me?" she inquired in an agitated whisper. "I've been to him, and he's not at home. I wrote down where he was to come and left it on his table with my own hand. They said he wouldn't be out long. I have tidings for him. Can you come directly?" My answer was to pass out at the gate immediately. She made a hasty gesture with her hand as if to entreat my patience and my silence, and turned towards London, whence, as her dress betokened, she had come expeditiously on foot. I asked her if that were not our destination. On her motioning yes with the same hasty gesture as before, I stopped an empty coach that was coming by, and we got in. When I asked her where the coachman was to drive, she answered, "Anywhere near Golden Square, and quick!" then shrunk into a corner with one trembling hand before her face, and the other making the former gesture as if she couldn't bear a voice. Now much disturbed, and dazzled with conflicting gleams of hope and dread, I looked at her for some explanation. But seeing how strongly she desired to remain quiet, and feeling that it was my own natural inclination too at such a time, I didn't attempt to break the silence. We proceeded without a word being spoken. Sometimes she glanced out of the window, as though she thought we were going slowly, though indeed we were going fast, but otherwise remained exactly as at first. We alighted at one of the entrances to the square she'd mentioned, where I directed the coach to wait, not knowing but that we might have some occasion for it. She laid her hand on my arm and hurried me on to one of the sombre streets, of which there are several in that part, where the houses were once fair dwellings in the occupation of single families, but have, and had, long degenerated into poor lodgings let off in rooms. Entering at the open door of one of these, and releasing my arm, She beckoned me to follow her up the common staircase, which was like a tributary channel to the street. The house swarmed with inmates. As we went up, doors of rooms were opened and people's heads put out, and we passed other people on the stairs who were coming down. In glancing up from the outside before we entered, I'd seen women and children lolling at the windows over flower pots, and we seemed to have attracted their curiosity, for these were principally the observers who looked out of their doors. It was a broad, panelled staircase with massive balustrades of some dark wood, cornices above the doors ornamented with carved fruit and flowers, and broad seats in the windows. But all these tokens of past grandeur were miserably decayed and dirty. Rot, damp, and age had weakened the flooring, which in many places was unsound and even unsafe. Some attempts had been made, I noticed, to infuse new blood into this dwindling frame by repairing the costly old woodwork here and there with common deal, but it was like the marriage of a reduced old noble to a plebeian pauper, and each party to the ill-assorted union shrunk away from the other. Several of the back windows on the staircase had been darkened or wholly blocked up. In those that remained there was scarcely any glass, and through the crumbling frames by which the bad air seemed always to come in and never to go out, I saw through other glassless windows into other houses in a similar condition, and looked giddily down into a wretched yard which was the common dust-heap of the mansion. We proceeded to the top story of the house. Two or three times, by the way, I thought I observed in the indistinct light the skirts of a female figure going up before us. As we turned to ascend the last flight of stairs between us and the roof, we caught a full view of this figure pausing for a moment at a door. Then it turned the handle and went in. "What's this?" said Martha in a whisper. "She's gone into my room. I don't know her."
I knew her. I had recognised her with amazement for Miss Dartle.
I said something to the effect that it was a lady whom I had seen before in a few words to my conductress, and had scarcely done so when we heard her voice in the room, though not from where we stood what she was saying. Martha, with an astonished look, repeated her former action and softly led me up the stairs, and then by a little back door which seemed to have no lock, and which she pushed open with a touch, into a small, empty garret with a low, sloping roof, little better than a cupboard. Between this and the room she called hers, there was a small door of communication standing partly open. Here we stopped, breathless with our ascent, and she placed a hand lightly on my lips. I could only see of the room beyond that it was pretty large, that there was a bed in it, and that there were some common pictures of ships upon the walls. I could not see Miss Darkle, or the person whom we had heard her address. Certainly my companion could not, for my position was the best. A dead silence prevailed for some moments. Martha kept one hand on my lips and raised the other in a listening attitude. "It matters little to me, her not being at home," said Rosa Dartle, haughtily. "I know nothing of her. It is you I come to see."
"Me?"
replied a soft voice. At the sound of it a thrill went through my frame, for it was Emily's. "Yes," returned Miss Dartle. "I have come to look at you." "What? You're not ashamed of the face that has done so much?" The resolute and unrelenting hatred of her tone, its cold, stern sharpness, and its mastered rage, presented her before me as if I had seen her standing in the light. I saw the flashing black eyes and the passion-wasted figure. I saw the scar with its white track cutting through her lips, quivering and throbbing as she spoke. "I have come to see," she said, "James Steerforth's fancy. The girl who ran away with him. That is the town-talk of the commonest people of a native place. The bold, flaunting, practised companion of persons like James Steerforth. I want to know what such a thing is like." There was a rustle, as if the unhappy girl on whom she heaped these taunts ran towards the door, and the speaker swiftly interposed herself before it. It was succeeded by a moment's pause. When Miss Dartle spoke again, it was through her set teeth and with a stamp upon the ground. "Stay there," she said, "or I'll proclaim you to the house and the whole street. If you try to evade me, I'll stop you, if it's by the hair, and raise the very stones against you." A frightened murmur was the only reply that reached my ears. A silence succeeded. I didn't know what to do. Much as I desired to put an end to the interview, I felt that I had no right to present myself, that it was for Mr. Peggotty alone to see and recover her. Would he never come? I thought impatiently. "Sir," said Rosa Dartle with a contemptuous laugh, "I see her at last. Why, he was a poor creature to be taken by that delicate mock modesty and that hanging head." "Oh, for heaven's sake, spare me," exclaimed Emily. "Whoever you are, you know my pitiable story, and for heaven's sake, spare me if you would be spared yourself." "If I would be spared," returned the other fiercely, "what is there in common between us, do you think?" "Nothing but our sex," said Emily with a burst of tears. "And that," said Rosa Dartle, "is so strong a claim, preferred by one so infamous, that if I had any feeling in my breast but scorn and abhorrence of you, it would freeze it up. Our sex! You are an honour to our sex."
"I have deserved this," cried Emily, "but it's dreadful. Dear, dear lady, think what I've suffered and how I'm fallen. Oh, Martha, come back! Oh, home, home!"
Miss Dartle placed herself in a chair within view of the door and looked downward as if Emily were crouching on the floor before her. Being now between me and the light, I could see her curled lip and her cruel eyes intently fixed on one place with a greedy triumph. "Listen to what I say," she said, "and reserve your false arts for your dupes. Do you hope to move me by your tears? No more than you could charm me by your smiles, you purchased slave."
"Oh, have some mercy on me," cried Emily. "Show me some compassion, or I shall die mad."
"It would be no great penance," said Rosa Dartle, "for your crimes. Do you know what you've done? Do you ever think of the home you have laid waste?"
"Oh, is there ever night or day when I don't think of it?" cried Emily.
And now I could just see her on her knees, with her head thrown back, her pale face looking upward, her hands wildly clasped and held out, and her hair streaming about her.
"Has there ever been a single minute, waking or sleeping, when it hasn't been before me, just as it used to be in the lost days, when I turned my back upon it forever and forever? Oh, home! Home! Oh, dear, dear uncle, if you ever could have known the agony your love would cause me when I fell away from good, you never would have shown it to me so constant much as you felt it, but would have been angry to me at least once in my life that I might have had some comfort. I have none, none, no comfort upon earth, for all of them were always fond of me."
She dropped on her face before the imperious figure in the chair, with an imploring effort to clasp the skirt of her dress. Rosa Dartle sat looking down upon her, as inflexible as a figure of brass. Her lips were tightly compressed, as if she knew that she must keep a strong constraint upon herself. I write what I sincerely believe, or she would be tempted to strike the beautiful form with her foot. I saw her countenance distinctly, and the whole power of her face and character seemed forced into that expression. Would he never come? "The miserable vanity of these earthworms," she said, when she had so far controlled the angry heavings of her breast that she could trust herself to speak. "Your home? Do you imagine that I bestow a thought on it, or suppose you could do any harm to that low place, which money wouldn't pay for and handsomer? Your home? You were a part of the trade of your home, and were bought and sold, like any other vendible thing your people dealt in."
"Oh, not that!" cried Emily. "Say anything of me, but don't visit my disgrace and shame more than I have done on folks who are as honourable as you. Have some respect for them as you're a lady, if you have no mercy for me." "I speak," she said, not deigning to take any heed of this appeal, and drawing away her dress from the contamination of Emily's touch. "I speak of his home, where I live. Here," she said, stretching out her hand with a contemptuous laugh and looking down upon the prostrate girl, "is a worthy cause of division between lady mother and gentleman son, of grief in a house where she wouldn't have been admitted as a kitchen girl, of anger and repining and reproach. This piece of pollution, picked up from the waterside to be made much of for an hour, and then tossed back to her original place." "No, no," cried Emily, clasping her hands together. "When he first came into my way, that the day had never dawned upon me and he'd met me being carried to my grave, I'd been brought up as virtuous as you or any lady, and was going to be the wife of as good a man as you or any lady in the world can ever marry. If you live in his home and know him, you know perhaps what his power with a weak, vain girl might be. I don't defend myself, but I know well, and he knows well, or he will know when he comes to die and his mind's troubled with it, that he used all his power to deceive me, and that I believed him, trusted him, and loved him." Rosa Dartle sprang up from her seat, recoiled, and in recoiling struck at her with a face of such malignity, so darkened and disfigured by passion, that I had almost thrown myself between them. The blow, which had no aim, fell upon the air. As she now stood panting, looking at her with the utmost detestation that she was capable of expressing, and trembling from head to foot with rage and scorn, I thought I had never seen such a sight and never could see such another. "You love him? You?" she cried, with her clenched hand quivering as if it only wanted a weapon to stab the object of her wrath. Emily had shrunk out of my view. There was no reply. "And tell that to me," she added, "with your shameful lips. Why don't they whip these creatures? If I could order it to be done, I would have this girl whipped to death." And so she would, I have no doubt. I would not have trusted her with the rack itself while that furious look lasted. She slowly, very slowly, broke into a laugh and pointed at Emily with her hand, as if she were a sight of shame for gods and men. "She love," she said, "that carrion! And he ever cared for her, she'd tell me. The liars that these traders are!" Her mockery was worse than her undisguised rage. Of the two, I would have much preferred to be the object of the latter. But when she suffered it to break loose, it was only for a moment. She chained it up again, and however it might tear her within, she subdued it to herself. "I came here, you pure fountain of love," she said, "to see, as I began by telling you, what such a thing as you was like. I was curious. I am satisfied. Also to tell you that you had best seek that home of yours with all speed, and hide your head among those excellent people who are expecting you, and whom your money will console. When it's all gone, you can believe and trust and love again, you know. I thought you a broken toy that had lasted its time, a worthless spangle that was tarnished and thrown away, but finding you true gold, a very lady and an ill-used innocent, with a fresh heart full of love and trustfulness, which you look like and is quite consistent with your story, I have something more to say. Attend to it. For what I say, I'll do. Do you hear me, you fairy spirit? What I say, I mean to do." Her rage got the better of her again for a moment, but it passed over her face like a spasm and left her smiling. "Hide yourself," she pursued, "if not at home, somewhere.
if it be somewhere beyond reach. In some obscure life, or better still, in some obscure death. I wonder if your loving heart will not break, you have found no way of helping it to be still. I've heard of such means sometimes. I believe they may be easily found.
A low crying on the part of Emily interrupted her here. She stopped, and listened to it, as if it were music.
I am of a strange nature, perhaps,
Rosa Dartle went on,
but I can't breathe freely in the air you breathe. I find it sickly. Therefore I will have it cleared. I will have it purified of you. If you live here tomorrow, I'll have your story and your character proclaimed on the common stair. There are decent women in the house, I'm told, and it is a pity such a light as you should be among them and concealed. If, leaving here, you seek any refuge in this town in any character but your true one, which you're welcome to bear without molestation from me, the same service shall be done you if I hear of your retreat. Being assisted by a gentleman who not long ago aspired to the favour of your hand, I am sanguine as to that.
Would he never, never come? How long was I to bear this? How long could I bear it?
Oh, me! Oh, me! Exclaimed the wretched Emily in a tone that might have touched the hardest heart. I should have thought. But there was no relenting in Rosa Dartle's smile.
What shall I do?
Do, returned the other. Live happy in your own reflections. Consecrate your existence to the recollection of James Steerforth's tenderness. He would have made you his serving man's wife, would he not? Or to feeling grateful to the upright and deserving creature who would have taken you as his gift. Or if those proud remembrances and the consciousness of your own virtues and the honourable position to which they have raised you in the eyes of everything that wears the human shape will not sustain you, marry that good man and be happy in his condescension. If this will not do either, die. There are doorways and dust heaps for such deaths and such despair. Find one and take your flight to heaven. I heard a distant foot upon the stairs. I knew it. I was certain it was his. Thank God! She moved slowly from before the door when she said this, and passed out of my sight. But mark, she added, slowly and sternly, opening the other door to go away, I am resolved, for reasons that I have and hatreds that I entertain, to cast you out unless you withdraw from my reach altogether or drop your pretty mask. This is what I had to say, and what I say I mean to do. The foot upon the stairs came nearer, nearer, past her as she went down, rushed into the room. Uncle! A fearful cry followed the word. I paused a moment and, looking in, saw him supporting her insensible figure in his arms. He gazed for a few seconds in the face, then stooped to kiss it. Oh, how tenderly! And drew a handkerchief before it.
Master Davy,
he said in a low, tremulous voice when it was covered.
I thank my heavenly Father as my dreams come true. I thank him heartily for having guided of me in his own ways to my darling.
With those words he took her up in his arms, and with the veiled face lying on his bosom and addressed towards his own, carried her, motionless and unconscious, down the stairs. Chapter 51. The Beginning of a Longer Journey. It was yet early in the morning of the following day, when, as I was walking in my garden with my aunt, who took little other exercise now, being so much in attendance on my dear Dora, I was told that Mr. Peggotty desired to speak with me. He came into the garden to meet me halfway on my going towards the gate, and bared his head, as it was always his custom to do when he saw my aunt, for whom he had a high respect. I'd been telling her all that had happened overnight. Without saying a word, she walked up with a cordial face, shook hands with him, and patted him on the arm. It was so expressively done that she had no need to say a word. Mr. Peggotty understood her quite as well as if she'd said a thousand. "I'll go in now, Trot," said my aunt, "and look after little Blossom, who'll be getting up presently." "Not long have I been here, ma'am, I hope," said Mr. Peggotty, "unless my witch is gone a bard's nasing," by which Mr. Peggotty meant to say bird's nesting, "this morning. 'Tis along o' me as you're going to quit us." "You have something to say, my good friend," returned my aunt, "and will do better without me." "By your leave, ma'am," returned Mr. Peggotty, "I should take it kind, provising you don't mind my clicketing, if you'd bide here." "Would you?" said my aunt, with short good nature. "Then I'm sure I will." So she drew her arm through Mr. Peggotty's and walked with him to a leafy little summer-house that was at the bottom of the garden, where she sat down on a bench, and I beside her. There was a seat for Mr. Peggotty, too, but he preferred to stand, leaning his hand on the small, rustic table. As he stood, looking at his cap for a little while before beginning to speak, I couldn't help observing what power and force of character his sinewy hand expressed, and what a good and trusty companion it was to his honest brow and iron grey hair. "I took my dear child away last night," Mr. Peggotty began, as he raised his eyes to ours, "to my lodging, where I have a long time been expecting of her and preparing for her. It was hours afore she knowed me right, and when she did, she knelt down at my feet and kind of said to me, as if it was her prayers, how it all come to be. You may believe me when I heard her voice, as I'd heard at home so playful, and see her humbled as it might be in the dust our Saviour wrote in with his blessed hand, I felt a wound go to my heart in the midst of all its thankfulness." He drew his sleeve across his face without any pretence of concealing why, and then cleared his throat. "It warn't for long as I felt that, for she was found. I had only to think as she was found and it was gone. I don't know why I do so much as mention of it now, I'm sure. I didn't have it in my mind a minute ago to say a word about myself, but it come up so natural that I yielded to it afore I was aware." "You're a self-denying soul," said my aunt, "and we'll have your reward." Mr. Peggotty, with the shadows of the leaves playing athwart his face, made a surprised inclination of the head towards my aunt as an acknowledgement of her good opinion, then took up the thread he'd relinquished. "When my Emily took flight," he said in stern wrath for the moment, "from the house where she was made a prisoner by that there spotted snake as Master Davy, see, and his story's true, and may God confound him, she took flight in the night. It was a dark night, with a many stars a-shining. She was wild. She ran along the sea-beach, believing the old boat was there, and calling out to us to turn away our faces, for she was a-coming by. She heard herself a-crying out like as if it was another person, and cut herself on them sharp-pinted stones and rocks, and felt it no more than if she'd been rock herself. Ever so fur she run, and there was fire afore her eyes and roarings in her ears. Of a sudden, or so she thought, you understand, the day broke wet and windy, and she was lying below a heap of stone upon the shore, and a woman was a speaking to her, saying in the language of that country, what was it as had gone so much amiss?" He saw everything he related. It passed before him as he spoke so vividly that, in the intensity of his earnestness, he presented what he described to me with greater distinctness than I can express. I can hardly believe, writing now long afterwards, but that I was actually present in these scenes. They're impressed upon me with such an astonishing air of fidelity. As Emily's eyes, which was heavy, see this woman better, Mr. Peggotty went on, she knowed as she was one of them as she'd often talked to on the beach. For though she'd run, as I've said, ever so fur in the night, she'd oftentimes wandered long ways, partly afoot, partly in boats and carriages, and knowed all that country along the coast, miles and miles. She hadn't no children of her own, this woman, being a young wife, but she was a-looking to have one afore long. And may my prayers go up to heaven that 'twill be a happiness to her, and a comfort, and a honour, all her life. May it love her, and be dutiful to her in her old age, helpful of her at the last, a angel to a here and hereafter. Amen, said my aunt. She'd been somewhat timorous and down, said Mr. Peggotty, and had sat at first a little way off at her spinning, or such work as it was, when Emily talked to the children. But Emily had took notice of her, and had gone and spoke to her, and as the young woman was partial to the children herself, they'd soon made friends. So much, sir, that when Emily went that way, she always give Emily flowers. This was her as now asked what it was that had gone so much amiss. Emily told her, and she took her home. She did indeed. She took her home, said Mr. Peggotty, covering his face. He was more affected by this act of kindness than I had ever seen him affected by anything since the night she went away. My aunt and I did not attempt to disturb him. "It was a little cottage, you may suppose," he said presently, "but she found space for Emily in it. Her husband was away at sea, and she kept it secret, and prevailed upon such neighbours as she had, they wasn't many near, to keep it secret too. Emily was took bad with fever, and what is very strange to me is, maybe it is not so strange to scholars, the language of that country went out of her head, and she could only speak her own, that no one understood. She recollects, as if she dreamt it, that she lay there, always a-talking her own tongue, always believing, as the old boat was round the next pint in the bay, and begging and imploring of them to send there and tell how she was dying, and bring back a message of forgiveness, if it was only a word. Almost the whole time she thought, now that him as I made mention on just now was lurking for her underneath the window, now that him as had brought her to this was in the room, and cried to the good young woman not to give her up, and knowed at the same time that she couldn't understand, and dreaded that she must be took away. Likewise, the fire was afore her eyes, and the roarings in her ears, and there was no today, nor yesterday, nor yet tomorrow, but everything in her life has ever had been, or has ever could be, and everything has never had been, and has never could be, was a crowding on her all at once, and nothing clear nor welcome, and yet she sang and laughed about it. How long this lasted, I don't know. But then, there come a sleep. And in that sleep, from being a many times stronger than her own self, she fell into the weakness of the littlest child. Here he stopped, as if for relief from the terrors of his own description. After being silent for a few moments, he pursued his story. It was a pleasant afternoon when she awoke, and so quiet that there weren't a sound but the rippling of that blue sea without a tide upon the shore. It was her belief at first that she was at home upon a Sunday morning. But the vine leaves, as she sees at the window, and the hills beyond, weren't home, and contradicted of her. Then come in her friend to watch alongside of her bed, and then she knowed as the old boat weren't round that next pint in the bay no more, but was fur off, and knowed where she was and why, and broke out a-crying on that good young woman's bosom, where I hope her baby's a-lying now, a-cheering of her with its pretty eyes. He couldn't speak of this good friend of Emily's without a flow of tears. It was in vain to try. He broke down again, endeavouring to bless her. "That done my Emily good," he resumed, after such emotion as I could not behold without sharing in.
But as to my aunt, she wept with all her heart. But done Emily good, and she begun to mend. But the language of that country was quite gone from her, and she was forced to make signs. So she went on getting better from day to day, slow but sure, and trying to learn the names for common things, names as she seemed never to have heard in all her life, till one evening come, when she was a-sitting at her window, looking at a little girl at play upon the beach. And of a sudden this child held out her hand and said what would be in English, "Fisherman's daughter, here's a shell." For you to understand that they used at first to call a pretty lady, as the general way in that country is, and that she taught them to call her fisherman's daughter instead. The child says of a sudden, "Fisherman's daughter, here's a shell." Then Emily understands her, and she answers, bursting out to cry, that it all comes back. "When Emily got strong again," said Mr. Peggotty after another short interval of silence, "she cast about to leave that good young creature and get to her own country. The husband was come home then, and the two together put her aboard a small trader bound to Leghorn, and from that to France. She had a little money, but it was less than little as they would take for all they'd done. I almost glad on it, though she was so poor. What they done is laid up where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. Master Davy, it'll outlast all the treasure in the world." Emily got to France, and took service to wait on travelling ladies at an inn in the port. There come one day that snake. "Let him never come nigh me. I don't know what hurt I might do him." Soon as she see him, without him seeing her, all her fear and wildness returned upon her, and she fled afore the very breath he drawed. She come to England, and was set ashore at Dover. "I don't know," said Mr. Peggotty, "for sure, when her heart began to fail her, but all the way to England she thought to come to her dear home. Soon as she got to England, she turned her face towards it. But fear of not being forgive, fear of being pinted at, fear of some of us being dead along of her, fear of many things, turned her from it kind of by force upon the road. Uncle, uncle," she says to me, "the fear of not being worthy to do what my torn and bleeding breast so longed to do was the most frightening fear of all. I turned back when my heart was full of prayers that I might crawl to the old doorstep in the night, kiss it, lay my wicked face upon it, and there be found dead in the morning." "She come," said Mr. Peggotty, dropping his voice to an awe-stricken whisper, "to London. She, as had never seen it in her life, alone, without a penny, young, so pretty, come to London. Almost the moment as she lighted here, all so desolate, she found, as she believed, a friend. A decent woman as spoke to her about the needlework as she'd been brought up to do, about finding plenty of it for her, about the lodging for the night, and making secret inquiration concerning of me and all at home tomorrow. When my child," he said aloud, and with an energy of gratitude that shook him from head to foot, "stood upon the brink of more than I can say or think on, Martha, true to her promise, saved her." I couldn't repress a cry of joy. "Master Davy," he said, griping my hand in that strong hand of his, "it was you as first made mention of her to me. I thank you, sir. She was earnest. She had knowed of her bitter knowledge where to watch and what to do. She had done it, and the Lord was above all. She come, white and hurried, upon Emily in her sleep. She says to her, 'Rise up from worse than death and come with me.' Them belonging to the house would have stopped her, but they might as soon have stopped the sea. 'Stand away from me,' she says. 'I am a ghost that calls her from beside her open grave.' She told Emily she'd seen me, and knowed I loved her and forgive her. She wrapped her hasty in her clothes. She took her faint and trembling on her arm. She heeded no more what they said than if she'd had no ears.
She walked among them with my child, minding only her, and brought her safe out in the dead of the night from that black pit of ruin. She attended on Emily, said Mr. Peggotty, who had released my hand and put his own hand on his heaving chest. She attended on Emily, lying wearied out and wandering betwixt whiles till late next day. Then she went in search of me, then in search of you, Master Davy. She didn't tell Emily what she come out for, lest her heart should fail, and she should think of hiding of herself. How the cruel lady knowed of her being near, I can't say. Whether him as I spoke so much of chance to see him going there, or whether, which is most like to my thinking, he heard it from the woman, I don't greatly ask myself. My niece is found. All night long, said Mr. Peggotty, we've been together, Emily and me. 'Tis little considering the time as she said in words through them broken-hearted tears. 'Tis less as I have seen of her dear face, as growed into a woman's at my hearth. But all night long, her arms has been about my neck, and her head is laid here. And we knows full well as we can put our trust in one another evermore. He ceased to speak, and his hand upon the table rested there in perfect repose, with a resolution in it that might have conquered lions.
This ends side one of cassette 23. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
It was a gleam of light upon me, Trot, said my aunt, drying her eyes, when I formed the resolution of being godmother to your sister Betsy Trotwood, who disappointed me. But next to that, hardly anything would have given me greater pleasure than to be godmother to that good young creature's baby. Mr. Peggotty nodded his understanding of my aunt's feelings, but couldn't trust himself with any verbal reference to the subject of her commendation. We all remained silent, and occupied with our own reflections, my aunt drying her eyes, and now sobbing convulsively, and now laughing and calling herself a fool, until I spoke. "You have quite made up your mind," said I to Mr. Peggotty, "as to the future, good friend." "I need hardly ask you." "Quite, Master Davy," he returned, "and told Emily, there's mighty countries far from here. Our future life lays over the sea." "They will emigrate together, aunt," said I. "Yes," said Mr. Peggotty with a hopeful smile. "No one can't reproach my darling in Australia. We'll begin a new life over there." I asked him if he yet proposed to himself any time for going away. "I was down at the docks early this morning, sir," he returned, "to get information concerning them ships. In about 6 weeks or 2 months from now, there'll be one sailing. I see her this morning, went aboard, and we shall take our passage in her." "Quite alone?" I asked. "Aye, Master Davy," he returned. "My sister, you see, she's that fond of you and yourn, and that accustomed to think only of her own country, that it wouldn't be hardly fair to let her go. Besides which, there's one she has in charge, Master Davy, as don't ought to be forgot." "Poor Ham," said I. "My good sister takes care of his house, you see, ma'am, and he takes kindly to her," Mr. Peggotty explained for my aunt's better information. "He'll sit and talk to her with a calm spirit when it's like he couldn't bring himself to open his lips to another." "Poor fella," said Mr. Peggotty, shaking his head. "There's not so much left him that he could spare the little as he has." "And Mrs. Gummidge?" said I. "Well, I've had a mort of consideration, I do tell you," returned Mr. Peggotty, beginning with a perplexed look which gradually cleared as he went on, "concerning of Mrs. Gummidge. You see, when Mrs. Gummidge falls a think of the old un, she ain't what you may call good company. Betwixt you and me, Master Davy, and you, ma'am, when Mrs. Gummidge takes to wimicking," our old country word for crying,
She's liable to be considered to be by them as didn't know the old un, peevish-like. Now, I did know the old un, said Mr. Peggotty, and I knowed his merits, so I understand her. But 'tan't entirely so, you see, with others. Naturally can't be.
My aunt and I both acquiesced.
Whereby, said Mr. Peggotty, my sister might, I don't say she would, but might, find Mrs. Gummidge give her a little trouble now and again. Therefore, 'tan't my intentions to moor Mrs. Gummidge long with them, but to find a being for her where she can fisherate for herself.
A being signifies in that dialect a home, and to fisherate is to provide.
For which purpose, said Mr. Peggotty, I means to make her allowance afore I go, as I leave her pretty comfortable. She's the faithfulest of creatures. 'Tan't be expected, of course, at her time of life, and being lone and lorn as the good old mothers, to be knocked about the board ship, than in the woods and wilds of a new and far away country. So that's what I'm a-going to do with her. He forgot nobody. He thought of everybody's claims and strivings but his own. Only, he continued, will keep along with me. Poor child, she's sore in need of peace and rest, until such time as we goes upon our voyage. She'll work at them clothes as must be made, and I hope her troubles will begin to seem longer ago than they was when she finds herself once more by a rough but loving uncle.
My aunt nodded confirmation of this hope, and imparted great satisfaction to Mr. Peggotty.
"There's one thing further, Master Davy," said he, putting his hand in his breast pocket, and gravely taking out the little paper bundle I'd seen before, which he unrolled on the table. "There's these here bank-notes, £50 and £10. To them I wish to add the money as she come away with. I've asked her about that, but not saying why, and have added of it up. I aren't a scholar. Would you be so kind as to see how 'tis?"
He handed me, apologetically for his scholarship, a piece of paper, and observed me while I looked it over. It was quite right.
"Thank you, sir," he said, taking it back. "This money, if you don't see objections, Master Davy, I shall put up, just before I go, in a cover directed to him, and put that up in another directed to his mother. I shall tell her in no more words than I speak to you what it's the price on, and that I'm gone and past receiving of it back."
I told him that I thought it would be right to do so, that I was thoroughly convinced it would be, since he felt it to be right. "I said that there was only one thing further," he proceeded with a grave smile when he'd made up his little bundle again and put it in his pocket, "but there was two. I weren't sure in my mind when I come out this morning as I could go and break the ham of my own self what had so thankfully happened. So I writ a letter while I was out and put it in the post office, telling of them how all was as 'tis, and that I should come down tomorrow to unload my mind of what little needs a doing of down there, and most like take my farewell leave of Yarmouth. And do you wish me to go with you?" said I, seeing that he left something unsaid.
"If you could do me that kind favour, Master Davy," he replied, "I know the sight on you would cheer him up a bit."
My little Dora, being in good spirits and very desirous that I should go, as I found on talking it over with her, I readily pledged myself to accompany him in accordance with his wish. Next morning, consequently, we were on the Yarmouth coach, and again travelling over the old ground. As we passed along the familiar street at night, Mr. Peggotty, in despite of all my remonstrances, carrying my bag, I glanced into Omer and Joram's shop and saw my old friend Mr. Omer there smoking his pipe. I felt reluctant to be present when Mr. Peggotty first met his sister and Ham, and made Mr. Omer my excuse for lingering behind.
"How is Mr. Omer after this long time?" said I, going in.
He fanned away the smoke of his pipe, that he might get a better view of me, and soon recognised me with great delight.
"I should get up, sir, to acknowledge such an honour as this visit,"
said he, "only my limbs are rather out of sorts, and I'm wheeled about. With the exception of my limbs and my breath, however, I'm as hearty as a man can be, I'm thankful to say." I congratulated him on his contented looks and his good spirits, and saw now that his easy chair went on wheels. "It's an ingenious thing, ain't it?" he inquired, following the direction of my glance, and polishing the elbow with his arm. "It runs as light as a feather, and tracks as true as a mail coach. Bless you, my little Minnie. My granddaughter, you know, Minnie's child, puts her little strength against the back, gives it a shove, and away we go, as clever and merry as ever you see anything. And I tell you what, it's a most uncommon chair to smoke a pipe in." I never saw such a good old fellow to make the best of a thing, and find out the enjoyment of it as Mr. Omer. He was as radiant as if his chair, his asthma, and the failure of his limbs were the various branches of a great invention for enhancing the luxury of a pipe. "I see more of the world, I can assure you," said Mr. Omer, "in this chair than ever I see out of it. You'd be surprised at the number of people that looks in of a day to have a chat. You really would. There's twice as much in the newspaper since I've taken to this chair as there used to be. As to general reading, dear me, what a lot of it I do get through. That's what I feel so strong, you know. If it had been my eyes, what should I have done? If it had been my ears, what should I have done? Being my limbs, what does it signify? Why, my limbs only made my breath shorter when I used them. And now, if I want to go out into the street or down to the sands, I've only got to call Dick, Joram's youngest apprentice, and away I go in my own carriage, like the Lord Mayor of London!" He half suffocated himself with laughing here. "Lord bless you," said Mr. Omer, resuming his pipe. "A man must take the fat with the lean. That's what he must make up his mind to in this life. Joram does a fine business. Excellent business." "I'm very glad to hear it," said I. "I knew you would be," said Mr. Omer. "And Joram and Minnie are like valentines. What more can a man expect? What's his limbs to that?" His supreme contempt for his own limbs as he sat smoking was one of the pleasantest oddities I've ever encountered. "And since I've took the general reading, you've took the general writing, eh, sir?" said Mr. Omer, surveying me admiringly. "What a lovely work that was of yours. What expressions in it. I read it every word, every word. And as to feeling sleepy, not at all." I laughingly expressed my satisfaction, but I must confess that I thought this association of ideas significant. "I give you my word and honour, sir," said Mr. Omer, "that when I lay that book upon the table and looked at it outside, compact in three separate and individual volumes, 1, 2, 3, I am as proud as Punch to think that I once had the honour of being connected with your family. And, dear me, it's a long time ago now, ain't it, over at Blunderstone, with a pretty little party laid along with the other party, and you quite a small party then yourself. Dear, dear." I changed the subject by referring to Emily. After assuring him that I didn't forget how interested he'd always been in her and how kindly he had always treated her, I gave him a general account of her restoration to her uncle by the aid of Martha, which I knew would please the old man. He listened with the utmost attention and said, feelingly, when I'd done, "I'm rejoiced at it, sir. It's the best news I've heard for many a day, dear, dear, dear. And what's going to be undertook for that unfortunate young woman, Martha, now?" "You touch a point that my thoughts have been dwelling on since yesterday," said I, "but on which I can give you no information yet, Mr. Omer. Mr. Peggotty hasn't alluded to it, and I have delicacy in doing so. I'm sure he's not forgotten it. He forgets nothing that is disinterested and good." "Because, you know," said Mr. Omer, taking himself up where he'd left off, "whatever is done, I should wish to be a member of. Put me down for anything you may consider right, and let me know. I never could think the girl all bad, and I'm glad to find she's not. So will my daughter Minnie be. Young women are contradictory creatures in some things. Her mother was just the same as her,
but their hearts are soft and kind. It's all show with Minnie about Martha. Why she should consider it necessary to make any show, I don't undertake to tell you, but it's all show, bless you. She'd do her any kindness in private. So, put me down for whatever you may consider right, will you be so good? And drop me a line where to forward it. Dear me, said Mr.